Chabad Danurg Audio.
This lecture is presented by Rabbi Lezer Gurkov, Rabbi at Congregation Beth Tfilah in London, Ontario.
Rabbi Gamliel taught, it says in the Torah, V'natan lecha rachamim v'richamcha v'hir becha, God will give you compassion and he will be compassionate toward you. Rabbi Gamliel explained this verse in the following manner. Kol hamirachem, all who is compassionate unto others, in other words, who uses the compassion that God gives to us, merachamin alav min hashamayim, it is deserving of compassion from heaven, that God is compassionate to those who are compassionate toward others. This is a teaching that very much reflects Rabbi Gamliel's own personality. Here's another story that reflects his humility. The Talmud tells of a journey that Rabbi Gamliel undertook together with Rabbi Yehoshua. They were on a ship heading abroad, overseas. Rabbi Gamliel took along enough bread for the journey. Rabbi Yehoshua took extra flour. Bread tends to go bad. Flour remains fresh. The journey took much longer than expected. The captain got lost. Rabbi Yehoshua had extra flour. Rabbi Gamliel used some of Rabbi Yehoshua's provisions. Rabbi Gamliel, you must keep in mind, was a wealthy man. Rabbi Yehoshua was a very poor man. Here is the wealthy leader eating of the poor man's provisions. Nevertheless, Rabbi Gamliel asked Rabbi Yehoshua, how did you know to bring extra provisions? Rabbi Yehoshua responded, I know that every 60 or 70 years there's a great star that arises, that ascends, and sometimes it's in the north and sometimes it's in the south. And when that star ascends, the navigators and the captains lose their sense of direction because they always navigate by the light of the north star. And this other star, which is so luminous, is able to confuse the captains and make them think that they're looking at the north star when it is in fact in the south. So I thought that our captain might also get confused, and it's very possible that the navigator would lose his way and it would take longer than we expected. Rabbi Gamliel was impressed. Rabbi Yehoshua had understood astronomy so well. He said to him, Rabbi Gamliel said to Rabbi Yehoshua, with such great wisdom, is it not a shame that you have to travel abroad for business purposes and you cannot find your own parnasa, your own livelihood at home? So Rabbi Yehoshua replied, are you surprised that I can't find my livelihood at home with my wisdom? Back at home we have two students. They are so wise that they can estimate the precise number of drops in the Atlantic Ocean. And they, or maybe it was the Mediterranean Ocean, but they can estimate the precise number of water drops in the ocean. And they don't even have bread to eat or water to drink. So Rabbi Gamliel replied, he didn't actually reply, Rabbi Gamliel resolved that when he came home, he would summon these two students and give them a position of authority, and thus they would be able to collect the salary. When he returned home, he summoned the students. Somehow they discerned what was behind the summons, and they didn't want to come. They didn't want a position of authority. Rabbi Gamliel summoned them a second time, and then rebuked them for not coming the first time. He said to them, you believe that I was trying to give you a position of authority. You misunderstand the meaning of authority when it comes to an appointment of a position among the Jewish people. It's not an authority, it's actually a sense of servitude. It's not srara, it's avdut. And he brought a proof from the following verse. This is a verse that refers to the story of Rechavam, the son of Shlomo, where he advised with his advisors, with his friends, asking whether he should respond positively to a request by the people that he should relax the taxes and release them from some of the strictures that Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, his father, had introduced. And so his advisor said to him, if you respond to them positively this time, then they'll come back to you with further requests. And before you know it, Eved Tihiyeh La'amazeh, you will be a servant to this nation rather than a king. So Rechavam's advisors meant it in a negative sense. Rabbi Gamliel understood it in a positive sense, because indeed the king of the Jewish people is their servant. And so he said to these two young men, he said, I'm not appointing you to a position of authority, but to a position of servitude. Which once again demonstrates to us Rabbi Gamliel's attitude toward the office that he filled. He did not allow it to get to his head. He was not himself an arrogant man. On the contrary, he was a humble man, a compassionate man, a man filled with mercy for a widow who had lost her children, a man filled with pity for a person that doesn't have enough food for himself and then he has to travel abroad to make extra money. And he was a man who saw himself as a servant of the people, who went against his grain to respond harshly to those who threatened the hegemony and the authority of the Sanhedrin because it was for the sake of the Jewish people. He saw himself as required to do what he needed to do in order to serve the Jewish people correctly. This sacrifice took an ultimate toll when Rabbi Gamliel was forced to pay the ultimate price. He paid with his very life for the objective, for the great goal of uniting the Jewish people and establishing the supreme authority of the Sanhedrin. And this occurred in the following story. I'll share with you the story that played out in the scene of the Academy of Yavne. The two great rabbis in Yavne were Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua, the two disciples of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. We'll have opportunity to discuss each of them separately. At one point, these two great friends engaged in a debate. The debate was, in fact, an obscure issue related to laws of purity and impurity. And Rabbi Eliezer's view was outvoted. Rabbi Eliezer refused to rescind his position. You have to remember, as we will learn soon, Rabbi Eliezer was a man who never said a thing he did not hear from his teachers. Every teaching he offered, he had clear memory that his teachers said it to him that way. So he was not going to back down on a position that he knew his teachers had given him. And so Rabbi Eliezer refused to accept the majority vote. Nevertheless, Rabbi Eliezer wanted to prove the correctness of his position, and so he said, if my position is correct, then let the stream that's flowing alongside the yeshiva in Yavne, the academy in Yavne, let that stream flow backwards. Well, the stream began to flow backwards, and Rabbi Yeshua was unimpressed. He said, we cannot bring proof from a stream of water. If you're interested in proving it to us, then prove it to us with an argument we can understand. And so Rabbi Eliezer said, if my position is correct, let the carob tree in the yard be uprooted. And the carob tree was uprooted. Again, Rabbi Yehoshua said, we cannot prove anything from an uprooted carob tree. And so Rabbi Eliezer said, if my position is correct, let the walls of the academy cave in. So the walls of the academy began to cave in. Rabbi Yeshua stood up and he loudly announced, he said, walls, the great scholars of Torah are debating each other in halacha. What is your business here? Well, the walls stopped caving midway, became the leaning walls of Yavne, so to speak. They didn't cave further out of honor, respect to Rabbi Yehoshua, and they didn't right themselves out of respect for Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer said, if my position is correct, let there be a voice that will call down from heaven and say so. So indeed a voice called down from heaven and said, Rabbi Eliezer's position is correct. Rabbi Yeshua stood up on his feet and he said, Torah lav b'shamayim hi. The Torah is no longer in heaven. God does not want us to obey His ruling in the areas that the Sanhedrin debates because He says so. He wants us to understand the Torah and to follow our own understanding and to vote. And it is God's instruction in the Torah that we vote according to understand our understanding and follow the majority vote. That this vote should not be dictated to us from above. Whatever is written into the Torah is written, and whatever is not written into the Torah depends on our oral transmission of Torah from Moshe at Sinai and on our understanding of it. So Rabbi Eliezer, either you explain your position in a persuasive manner and we will change our vote, or you will have to accept the supreme ruling of the Sanhedrin. This is Rabbi Yehoshua, who demonstrated many times that he felt the ruling of the majority vote was more important than a personal opinion, as we described so many stories of Rabbi Yehoshua and Rabbi Gamliel's interaction, and how Rabbi Yehoshua repeatedly accepted Rabbi Gamliel's rebuke because he felt the overarching importance of the ruling of the Sanhedrin. Nevertheless, Rabbi Eliezer could not allow himself to backtrack because he knew beyond the shadow of a doubt that this was the way his teacher explained it to him. Rabbi Eliezer is credited by his teacher as having a mind like a cemented cistern. He never missed a single detail. He never lost a single halacha. He forgot nothing. He knew this was his teacher's teaching, and he would not back down. And so with no other choice, after Rabbi Eliezer left the academy with a very hard heart, Rabbi Yehoshua led the sages in his position as the Av Bet Din, a position he inherited from his teacher Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yehoshua led his colleagues in an excommunication of Rabbi Eliezer. He banned his own personal friend from the academy. This was a terrible day for the students of the academy and a terrible day for Rabbi Eliezer. They said to each other, who should go and tell Rabbi Eliezer? And it was determined that Rabbi Akiva would. Rabbi Akiva had a wonderful way with words. So Rabbi Akiva went to Rabbi Eliezer. He went to where Rabbi Eliezer lived in Lud. He dressed in black and he covered himself in a black cloak and a black talit. And he sat down four cubits from Rabbi Eliezer. And he cried. So Rabbi Eliezer said, Akiva, why do you cry? And Rabbi Akiva said, it is my impression that the sages have separated themselves from you. He couldn't bring himself to say the words ban or excommunication. Rabbi Eliezer immediately understood. He rent his garments, he took off his shoes, he sat down on the floor, and he mourned and he grieved like you would for a lost child. And he cried together with Rabbi Akiva, but he would not rescind his position. He felt powerless in the face of his rabbis, of his teacher's teachings. The Talmud tells us that the world grieved along with him. That, in fact, during that year, a third of the crops went bad. A third of the olives went bad, a third of the wheat went bad, and a third of the barley went bad. Furthermore, the Talmud tells us that Rabbi Gamliel was on a ship, he was on an ocean on another one of his many voyages. And suddenly a storm overtook the ship and threatened to capsize the ship. Rabbi Gamliel understood immediately what had happened, and so he stood up in the stern of the ship and he called out, Lo lichvodi, I didn't do this for my glory, velo lichvod bet Abba, and I didn't do this for my father's glory, I did it for the sake of God, I did it for the sake of Torah, I did it for the sake of Israel. And when he said that, the storm abated, because God recognized the truth when he heard it. Rabbi Gamliel was not a power-hungry authoritarian. Rabbi Gamliel was a heartbroken, humbled man who felt he served the Jewish people correctly when he pursued the authority of the Bet Din with vigor. And Rabbi Eliezer, as we will see at this point, was married to Rabbi Gamliel's sister. Rabbi Gamliel excommunicated his own brother-in-law. His sister was torn, her husband on one side, her brother on the other. One thing she wanted to make sure is that no harm befall her brother because he had displeased and caused anxiety and caused sadness and grief to a great man such as Rabbi Eliezer. And so she pleaded with Rabbi Eliezer to never recite the section of the prayers called Tachanun where you fall down you put your face down on your arm, because in that section of prayer there is a verse that we proclaim in which we plead with God to please grant our requests and punish our enemies and those who have caused us grief. And she knew that her brother had caused her husband grief, and she never wanted her husband to utter those words in prayer. So she stood over him every day as he prayed, and she prevented him from reciting those words. One day she was distracted. The Talmud says it was either Rosh Chodesh, and she thought that he would not say the Tachanun because it's Rosh Chodesh is a day you don't say this prayer, you don't say Tachanun on Rosh Chodesh. Or the Talmud tells us it's possible that she was distracted because she was at the door handing some charity to a poor man who came to the door. She came back into the room where her husband was praying and she saw that he had his head down in his arms and he was praying that specific prayer. Immediately she called out, she said, you must stop, you've killed my brother. And as she uttered those words, word came out in the street that Rabbi Gamliel had passed away. Rabbi Eliezer was in shock and he said to his wife, whose name was Emma Shalom, he said, Emma, how did you know this? And Emma replied, Kaf mikublani mi beit Abba, this is the tradition I have from my father's home. Kol ha-she'arim ninalin, all the gates may at one time or another be closed. Chutz misha'ar ona'a, except for the gate through which the cry of the oppressed rises to God. If someone is oppressed and he cries to God, God will always hear their appeal. He will always hear their pleading. And I knew if you would call out to God from your position of distress, He would hear you. And I knew my brother would have to pay the ultimate price, and he did. Rabbi Gamliel knowingly understood the consequences of his actions against Rabbi Eliezer. He understood that he was distressing a man of great stature who held a very high position in the eyes of God. Nevertheless, he felt he was a servant of the Torah and of the Jewish people. It was something he needed to do. He absolutely must do. And so Rabbi Gamliel, despite his natural humility, undertook harsh measures against anyone who defied the authority of the Sanhedrin, even his brother-in-law, even his very life. To give some perspective of Rabbi Eliezer's point of view and why he didn't rescind his position, it's appropriate to look at a story of Akavya ben Mahalalel. Akavya was in a similar position where he disagreed with the sages on four key points of law, and the rabbis offered him the position of Av Bet Din, of Supreme Justice, if only he changes his mind. And Akavya refused, and he said, I will go to my grave excommunicated. No one will ever say Akavya changed his mind for the position of honor. No one will ever be able to say that Akavya was bribed. But yet, Akavya, who was excommunicated, and he lived out his life in solitude because the rabbis stayed away from him since he was banned. He said to his son on his deathbed, he said, my son, I don't want you to follow my opinion. I want you to accept the overarching ruling of the Sanhedrin. Because I had no choice. I heard my teachers expound upon this law in a manner that was different from the Sanhedrin today, so I had to follow that teaching. But in my day, my teachers told me that this teaching reflects the majority opinion. So I know my colleagues were mistaken. So I had no choice but to follow the majority opinion of my teacher's generation. But you are in a new generation where from your point of view, the scholars of the generation had formulated a different law. What you hear from me is the opinion of the minority. And you should never take on the minority's opinion in the face of the majority. So Rabbi Eliezer saw himself in a similar position as Akavya was. Today I'm in the minority, but I know without a doubt that this position reflects the opinion of the majority of our forebears. And I don't want to reverse that. His colleagues who did not have the same memory were under the impression that their position in fact reflected the majority view of their forebears. They therefore changed the formulation of the law, or unknowingly changed it, but they felt that the law should be different. And as we understand today, the halacha follows the ruling of the Sanhedrin, whether it conforms with the previous Sanhedrin's ruling or it does not. So therein lies the difference between Rabbi Eliezer and the other scholars who were able to accept the majority rule and Rabbi Eliezer who was not. We turn back to Rabbi Gamliel at this point and we talk a little bit about his relations with Rome. Rabbi Gamliel's authority was respected by Rome. There was one point where he traveled to Syria, which was the seat of the Roman procurator's palace. And he went there, Lekabel Rishut. The Talmud in this tractate of Ediyot tells us that. We're not really certain what it means. The Talmud offers no commentary. It's possible, some argue, that it's possible to say he went to accept Rishut. Rishut can mean permission. It could also mean, Rashut can also mean authority. As we see in the first chapter of Ethics of Our Fathers, of Avot, Shammai says, Al titvada, do not associate la Rashut, to the authorities, to the government. So it is possible that Rabbi Gamliel traveled to Syria, Lekabel Rishut, to accept official authority from Rome for his position. He was respected in Rome as a representative of the Jewish people. His life was saved by an individual of Roman nobility. We already know that as a youngster, he and his father were in hiding because it was the position of Rome to target the leaders of the peoples they were in war with, in war against. And then because of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's successful negotiations, Rabbi Gamliel's life was spared. But in a later stage, the Senate in Rome determined that Rabbi Gamliel's life should be taken. And so they sent secret agents to take Rabbi Gamliel and to bring him to Rome for his execution. And one of the great senators of Rome got wind of it, and he was a secret admirer of Rabbi Gamliel. So he went off to Yavne and he came to the academy and he called out, Bal hachotem mitbakesh, the man of the nose has been summoned. And then he left. People brought the message to Rabbi Gamliel. He immediately understood that who is the man of the nose? That is the Nasi, the leader of the generation. Why is he called the lead man of the nose? Just as a nose beautifies a face, so does the Nasi beautify the generation. Hasidic understanding provides a deeper insight when it says that of all five senses, the sense of smell is the least tangible, and as such is the one that has the greatest association with the soul, because it is most spiritual in terms of all five senses. And so the Baal HaChotem is the Nasi, because he is the link between the Jewish people and God. He is the soul, the spirit of the people. And so they understood that if a Roman nobleman says that he is being summoned, they knew that he had to be summoned by Rome, and they understood the dangers. And so Rabbi Gamliel went into hiding. This nobleman came after Rabbi Gamliel into his hiding place, and he said, "If I save your life, will you promise me a share in the world to come?" Rabbi Gamliel promised, and this nobleman took his life. Now there was a rule in the Senate during that time, and we'll see on a number of occasions that the Roman senators took advantage of this rule on behalf of the Jewish people. If a senator died, then all issues that stood before the Senate were immediately dismissed, until such time as a new senator could be appointed. And then new issues would come forth, and the old issues would be forgotten. And so this senator climbed up to the roof and threw himself down to his death. He committed suicide. With his death, he saved Rabbi Yehoshua's life. And indeed, a voice came down from heaven saying that both Rabbi Gamliel and the man who saved him have a share in the world to come. There's another story of a voyage that Rabbi Gamliel made to Rome, and during the course of that voyage they tried to rescind a decree against the Jewish people, but they were unsuccessful in doing so. And so one of the senators, who was an admirer of the Jewish people, approached Rabbi Gamliel and explained the severity of the situation. Rabbi Gamliel was distraught, and the senator comforted him, saying, "You have a great God, and there are still 30 days until the execution of this decree. And so many things can happen during that time." 25 days after this, the senator was sitting with his wife, and he said, "What a shame, the Jews still haven't seen their salvation." His wife said to the senator, "You know how you can bring about the salvation." And she gave him a knowing look, looking down at his ring, and he always carried a poison in his ring in case he would ever need to dispatch himself quickly from life in some kind of desperate situation that may arise, one never knows. And so the senator looked down at the ring and he said, "I too thought about this, and I wanted your consent." And on the 30th day, he ingested the poison and he died. With his death, the decree was rescinded, and the rabbis came secretly to offer condolences to the widow. And they said to her allegorically, "It is a shame that the ship left without its captain." What they meant to say is, "It is a shame that the senator died for Jews but never converted to Judaism." So she said, "I can testify that the ship did not leave without its captain. In fact, I have a box here," and she brought it out to him, and in it there were some cloths and the foreskin of her deceased husband. And she said, "Here, I want to demonstrate to you, he circumcised himself before he passed away, before he took his life." So Rabbi Gamliel's influence extended to such a great degree that it even permeated the circles of the Roman Senate. Rabbi Gamliel had many debates with both the members of the Roman Senate and also with the early Christians. When the Talmud speaks of Amin, the Talmud more often than not refers to the early Christians. In one debate, he was told that your Lord is a thief. Why is he a thief? Because he stole a rib from Adam. Of course, in the book of Genesis, we are told that God took Adam's, surgically removed a rib from Adam and formed that into a woman and gave Adam Chava, who was a beautiful woman, the mother of all living beings, Eim Kol Chai. So Rabbi Gamliel's daughter said to her father, "Leave this one alone, let me answer it." Now, there are some historians who argue that this daughter of his is in fact his sister, who was Eima Shalom, the one who was married to Rabbi Eliezer, but I see no proof for this argument in the Talmud itself. So the daughter responded in the following way. She said, I need a police officer to come to the house and to protect us. Last night we had a robbery. The thief took all of our copper ornaments and he left gold and silver ornaments. So the man said, such a thief is a wonderful thief. May there be more such thieves. So Rabbi Gamliel's daughter replied, that's exactly what God did. He took a rib and he gave him a woman. And so the debater, the interlocutor, replied, I understand that, he said. But on the other hand, why couldn't he show Adam what he was doing? Why did he act as a thief in the night? Why did he do this when Adam was sleeping? So Rabbi Gamliel's daughter asked if anyone has a raw piece of meat. So they brought her some meat. She brought her the meat, so she salted it, and she washed it, she extracted the blood, and then she cooked it, and she gave it to the man. She said, here, have some meat. And he said to her, no, now that I saw the meat in its original state, it nim'asli, it's despicable to me, I can't possibly eat it. And so Rabbi Gamliel's daughter said to him, in the same sense, Adam could not have possibly viewed Chava with the same perception, with the same eyes, if he had seen the original state from which she was formed. So that was one debate. There was another debate in which the men of Rome asked Rabbi Gamliel if the dead can be resurrected. And Rabbi Gamliel offered a number of verses, and they were able to reject each of them. And a great debate ensued. And finally, Rabbi Gamliel offered the following verse. He said, we read in the book of Deuteronomy that there is a land, the land of Israel, that God promised to your ancestors to give to them. Latet lahem, to give to them. He doesn't say there to give to you, to the people he was talking to. He said to give to them. That is to say, the people, the ancestors, Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, to whom God was talking at that time, or even if you argue that it was the generation that left Egypt, these people had long deceased by the time the Jews entered Israel. So how could God have promised to give it to them? Unless you suppose that the Torah knows that the dead will be resurrected. And this argument was accepted. There was a fellow that came to Rabbi Gamliel and said to him, what's the great deal that you say, Mona Mispar Lakochavim, God can count the stars? I too can count the stars. So Rabbi Gamliel took some wheat kernels and he put them in a sieve. And he started turning the sieve around and around, and he asked the man, can you count the kernels? And the man said, stop turning it and I'll count it. So Rabbi Gamliel said, you see the stars from your point of view, and to you everything is stable. But God views the world from an outside perspective, and the world is constantly spinning. And as such, can you count the stars if you saw them spinning as God sees them? At one point, an early Christian, came to Rabbi Gamliel and said to him, I can tell you what God is doing. Right now, I can tell you what He's doing. And so Rabbi Gamliel said to him, Rabbi Gamliel saw that he was a sad person. He had sighed in the middle of his talk. And Rabbi Gamliel said, oh, what's bothering you? And so he said, I'm so sad, I have my son who's at a distance fighting in the Roman legions. Rabbi Gamliel said, you don't know what's going on with your son who is here in this world, and you're going to tell me what God's doing in the heavens. And there was another case where Rabbi Gamliel said to the man, how many teeth do you have? And the man put his half finger in his mouth and started counting. Rabbi Gamliel laughed at him and said, you can't tell me how many teeth are in your mouth without counting, and you think you can tell me what God is doing? There was another time when someone came up to Rabbi Gamliel and quoted a verse in which it said that God performed chalitza, that God cut his relationship, cut his ties for the Jewish people. So Rabbi Gamliel indicated that he had misunderstood the verse. It doesn't say in the verse chalatz mehem that he cut away from the Jewish people, but chalatz lahem, he cut himself toward the Jewish people. So obviously he misunderstood the deeper meaning of the verse. There was a case of a person who asked Rabbi Gamliel, who created the heaven and the earth? After all, it seems that it says in one place that God is Yotzer Aretz, that God forms the heavens. And in another place it says, he's Yotzer Harim, sorry, that he forms the mountains. In another place it says, Borei Ruach, that he creates the wind. So there is one God who creates the wind and another God who forms the mountains. They each have their own way. One creates, one forms. And so Rabbi Gamliel said, it also says, Hayotzer Ayin Halo Yabit, one who forms the eye, he surely can see. And Anota Ozen Halo Yishma, he who implants the ear, surely he can hear. So do you suggest that the implanter of the ear and that the former of the eye are two different gods? And if you say he is, they are two different gods, and is each limb created by a different god? And if you say that that is the case, then what happens at death? Do all the gods convene and agree that this is the time to die? So Rabban Gamliel refuted his position that it could be more than one god creating a single human body or the world at large, because truly, if there were two creators, then how can one flow of events occur without the two getting into an argument from time to time? There was also a story of someone who approached Rabban Gamliel and said to him, I suggest that God created heaven and earth, but he had some helpers, because on the first day of creation we see that he created that there was water and there was light, and these things were never created. It doesn't say in the Torah that he created water. There was chaos. He never created chaos. These things were there already. So perhaps he received able assistance from the water and from the spirit, from the ruach, and from the light. So Rabban Gamliel was able to quote to him many other verses in which the Torah is very clear on the fact that the light was created by God, and that the water was created by God, and that in fact the spirit was created by God, etc., etc. So Rabban Gamliel was truly a representative of the Jewish people, carrying their cause forward in all manner of debate, both against internal enemies, that is the Hebrew Christians, and external enemies, that is the Roman nobility and senators. We move on to personal anecdotes. The Talmud tells a story. One day Rabban Gamliel was on the ship with many of his colleagues, and no one had a lulav, because lulavim were scarce during that time. Lulav is the palm branch that we shake and recite a bracha over during the holiday, the festival of Sukkot. And so only Rabban Gamliel had a lulav, and he had purchased his lulav for 1,000 zuz. That's an inordinate sum of money. And then he shared his lulav with his colleagues in a legally permissible, in a halachically permissible manner. And this shows us Rabban Gamliel's incredible love for a mitzvah, that he would spend so much money to purchase a lulav. The sages taught that on our wedding night, a person is not required to recite the Shema, because it's very difficult to recite it with proper kavanah, with proper concentration. You're one is so excited on his wedding night. And yet Rabban Gamliel recited the Shema on his wedding night. And when his students asked him, Rabbi, have you not taught us that one is not required to recite the Shema on their wedding night? Rabban Gamliel said, I will not listen to you to miss even a single mitzvah or a single evening of Shema. That's how important the Shema was to him. Rabban Gamliel came home from his wife's funeral and he bathed himself. We know it's forbidden to bathe during Shiva. So his students asked him, how is it, did you not teach us it's forbidden to bathe during Shiva? Rabban Gamliel said, I am in a different situation. I am an istinis. I'm a very sensitive man. My skin crawls on me if I don't bathe every day. And so that's why I bathe, and that there is a special exemption for extremely sensitive people. Rabban Gamliel had a wonderful slave who wasn't Jewish, and his name was Tevi. And Rabban Gamliel thought very highly of Tevi. And Rabban Gamliel unfortunately outlived Tevi. Well, fortunately for Rabban Gamliel, but Tevi died during Rabban Gamliel's time. And after Tevi's funeral, Rabban Gamliel accepted condolences. Now his students were surprised. They said, have you not taught us that one does not accept condolences for one's non-Jewish slave? And Rabban Gamliel said, Tevi is different, because Tevi was a kosher person. He was a very honorable and a very ethical slave. So I accept condolences for him. We will talk very soon about a particular form of levirate marriages which were in dispute between the house of Shammai and the house of Hillel. This refers to a situation where a person marries his own niece and then also marries another woman. Polygamy is not forbidden by Jewish law, despite the fact that we have already undertaken not to engage in polygamy because of the restrictions placed upon polygamy by Rabbeinu Gershom Me'or HaGola back around 1,000 years ago. So there is a restriction that is on the basis of custom against polygamy, but Jewish law doesn't forbid polygamy. So what happens when a Jewish man marries his niece, which is permissible, and another woman, and then he passes away without having any children? So there is a requirement for the second brother to marry the woman of the deceased brother so that they can establish a child in the name of the brother, of the deceased brother. But in this case, the brother had two wives, one of which is the daughter of one of the brothers. So this brother surely cannot marry his own daughter, but can he marry his daughter's co-wife? And this was a matter of dispute between Bet Shammai and Bet Hillel, and Rabbi Gamliel was in exactly such a situation. He had a brother who married his daughter and who married another woman. And when his brother passed away without children, Rabbi Gamliel went ahead and married his daughter's co-wife, despite the fact that Bet Hillel frowned upon such a marriage. And nevertheless, Rabbi Gamliel performed it. And it was surprising to the rabbinate. And then it was determined that his daughter was an ailunit. His daughter was a woman that was incapable of bearing children. And even the house of Hillel would have agreed that if one's daughter is a barren woman, then it's permissible to marry the daughter's co-wife in a situation where you are required to perform a levirate marriage. So Rabbi Gamliel fulfilled his obligation to his daughter's co-wife, and he married her, and we don't know whether or not he sired a child on behalf of his brother. But this also gives us a little glimpse into Rabbi Gamliel's personal life, because his daughter was unfortunately a barren woman. Rabbi Gamliel's own home was often conducted in accordance with the more stringent view of Shammai. Remember, Rabbi Gamliel was a great grandson of Hillel. He was surely the champion of Hillel's cause, but personally he often conducted himself in accordance with Shammai. One brief example, Hillel and Shammai disagreed over whether it's permissible to give laundry to a non-Jewish laundromat, as long as you provide enough time for them to do the work before Shabbos. So Bet Hillel said it's permissible to give them just enough time to do the work. And Bet Shammai said, you have to be certain that they won't do the work on Shabbos. So you can't give them your laundry an hour before Shabbos and pick it up after Shabbos, because they have the option of doing the work in the hour before Shabbos, and it's not your business whether or not they do the work on Shabbos. Bet Shammai says it's forbidden. Bet Hillel says it's permissible. Our view of halakha is in accordance with Bet Hillel. We permit this kind of activity. In Rabbi Gamliel's home, they were so stringent that they went beyond even Bet Shammai's norm. They would not provide laundry to a laundromat, even if it was even a non-Jewish laundromat, any time within 3 days from Shabbat, in case the laundromat should launder the clothing during Shabbat. So he was the champion of Halakha and of the Sanhedrin. He was the great-grandson of Hillel, but personally conducted himself according to a very stringent policy, a very stringent level, not that he advocated that level for the normative halacha. At one point, he boasted to Rabbi Yehoshua that he had freed his slave Tavi, because he had inadvertently caused an injury to Tavi, and the halacha is that if you inadvertently injure your non-Jewish slave, then the slave automatically goes free. And this caused Rabbi Gamliel a great deal of joy, because he loved his slave. Only a Jew is forbidden to free a non-Jewish slave, and so he felt that here was his opportunity to free him. And Rabbi Yehoshua told him that in his case there was an exception, since he freely acknowledged what he had done, and the Torah's law about a slave being spontaneously freed if he's injured by his master only applies in a situation where the master denies it and two witnesses can testify to that effect. An interesting anecdote that shows us that his own sensitivity toward his slave and how he really wanted to free him. The Talmud also tells us that Rabbi Gamliel conducted a Seder literally until dawn. And we know in the Haggadah that Rabbi Gamliel's students and his colleagues, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Yehoshua, they also gathered in Rabbi Akiva's home in Bnei Brak to conduct the Seder literally until dawn. And it is very possible that they simply followed the lead of their teacher, of Rabbi Gamliel. We know also that Rabbi Gamliel is the one who coined the most important section of the Haggadah, the part that is introduced by the words, Rabbi Gamliel would say, he who has not cited these three points of the Haggadah is considered as if he hasn't fulfilled his obligation, and that is to talk about the matzah and the maror and the paschal lamb. Rabbi Gamliel recognized during his days an awful tragedy, and that is the competition, the stiff competition that existed between wealthy families in terms of how ornate a box the deceased will be buried in. And so Rabbi Gamliel recognized that this was a very big problem, because in addition to losing a loved one, families often left the loved one to rot, and not bury him because the cost of burial skyrocketed. How expensive the shrouds will be, how beautiful the flowers will be, how ornate the coffin will be. And so Rabbi Gamliel told his family he wants to be buried in simple linen shrouds. And with this, he broke the back of this terrible competition, and he established the custom that exists until today, that Jews are buried in simple shrouds and a simple wood coffin. Some of Rabbi Gamliel's halachic achievements. Rabbi Gamliel, as we mentioned, authored the essence of the Haggadah, the most important part of the Haggadah. Rabbi Gamliel, under his supervision, the Amidah was arranged. The specific text of the Amidah that we read today was arranged under Rabbi Gamliel by a scribe by the name of Shimon HaPikuli. Rabbi Gamliel inspired the 19th blessing of the Amidah. In fact, he called for a volunteer to write the 19th blessing. This was during the time of the early Christians, and they were causing great difficulties for the Jewish people. They were a fifth column within the Jewish people, tearing Jews away from the bosom of their faith. So Rabbi Gamliel tried to counteract that with coining a blessing that cursed all those who informed against the Jewish people and all who acted in a manner of heresy that is a description of the early Hebrew Christians. Until today, we read that 19th blessing. Rabbi Gamliel instituted times of prayer, that it's required to pray once in the morning, once in the afternoon. He wanted also to create a required time of prayer for the evening, but as we saw earlier on in this discussion, he was unsuccessful in his bid for that. Also, the required times for prayer were stiffly resisted by his colleagues. Rabbi Akiva felt a person should only pray if he's fluent with the words of the prayer. He shouldn't just pray at any time just because the time has come. Rabbi Eliezer felt a person should never pray if his prayer has become rote and familiar to him. A prayer should be prayed only out of passion and only out of great concentration. Rabbi Yeshua said a person's prayer should be brief because it's difficult to maintain concentration for such a long time. Rabbi Gamliel overruled them and was able to push through a legislation that required regular prayer times. And today that has become our tradition. This is how we pray. Nevertheless, he was unable to institute a required prayer time for the evening because, of course, that was too difficult. The resistance was too stiff, as we discussed before. His crown achievement remains uniting the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai by bringing all Jews under the banner of one halachic status, which is the vote of the Sanhedrin, the majority vote of the Sanhedrin. I want to share with you how deep was the conflict between the two schools that Rabbi Gamliel took on, and how he had to literally uproot the resistance from between the two houses. There were so many issues, but the Talmud tells us about stiff reaction to some of them. There was a dispute between Hillel and Shammai, or between the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai, about whether it's permissible to bring a certain sacrifice on a chag that happens to fall on Shabbos. And in fact, Hillel was spotted bringing the sacrifice to the Beit HaMikdash on a chag that fell on Shabbos. And he was accosted by one of the students of Shammai, who said, "How dare you bring the sacrifice? We believe it's wrong." It's for a student of Shammai to approach the venerated Hillel, who was the Nasi in his time, was an incredible act of chutzpah, of temerity. But it goes to show how deeply ingrained the positions had become. Hillel was a humble man, more prone towards conciliation, so he denied that he was bringing the sacrifice for that purpose. He said he was bringing a different sacrifice. And in fact, the other sacrifice that he claimed to be bringing could only be of a female. The sacrifice that he was suspected of bringing had to be a male, and the sacrifice he claimed to be bringing could also be a female. So Hillel claimed that his sheep was a female, and he put the tail in a particular position so that the sex of the animal would not be discernible from the position of the student of Shammai. And so when Shammai's student saw Hillel back down, he said, "Well, in that case, I think it's appropriate for us to formulate a halacha, because even Hillel agrees with us." And they were prepared to pass the halacha in accordance with Shammai. And there was one great sage, Baba ben Buta. He was a student of Shammai, but in this case he agreed with Hillel. So he purchased thousands of animals, and he brought them to the Temple Mount, and he announced, Anyone who would like to bring the sacrifice in accordance with the position of Hillel may take one of these animals and use them for a sacrifice. And with that, the halacha remained unformulated until such time as they determined in Yavne that the halacha would follow Hillel's position. So this shows us the incredible entrenchment of the two sides. At another time, one of Hillel's students was approached by a student of Shammai when he brought such a sacrifice. And the Shammai student said to him, Smicha mahi, what kind of smicha is this? Smicha means leaning on the animal, which is the chief problem that the students of Shammai had. To lean on an animal on Shabbos is tantamount to riding the animal on Shabbos, which is forbidden to do. And so the student of Hillel replied succinctly, Shtika mahi, what kind of silence is this? Why is it that you're not just simply living and let live? You know your position, why don't you respect my position? So there was a great antagonism there. But the antagonism was only a halachic one. It wasn't a social one. Despite the fact that they had different positions on the question of levirate marriage, as I shared with you before, nevertheless, the students of Hillel and the students of Shammai would marry into each other's families, and never would one person suspect the other person of offering for marriage a child that was the product of a levirate marriage that the other side disapproved of. Because, of course, according to that side, the product of such a marriage would be a mamzer, would be a bastard. And never did they suspect that one side would mislead the other side just so that they can get them to follow their own view. Because they intermarried, and they had social friendships, as the Talmud tells us, there was a dispute about the minimum measure of a sukkah. And the sages of Shammai and the sages of Hillel debated that particular issue. And the sages of Hillel reminded the sages of Shammai that they had once gone together to visit a great venerable sage in his sukkah, and that it was a very small sukkah. And so this shows us that they went to visit people together, they intermarried into each other's families, and that their only antagonism was a halachic antagonism, but it was a deeply entrenched halachic antagonism. There was a dispute as to whether one is required to lie down on one side when one is reciting the Shema during the evening and stand on one's feet when one is reciting the Shema during the morning. Because it says in the Torah that we recite the Shema b'shachbecha uv'kumecha, when you lie and when you stand. Bet Hillel understood this to mean b'shachbecha, at a time that most people lie down to go to sleep, meaning in the evening, uv'kumecha, a time that most people stand up from bed, meaning in the morning. Bet Shammai understood it literally. And so there was a dispute. Rabbi Yishmael once came and said that I was walking in the street and it came time to say the evening Shema, so I laid myself down. Not because I think Shammai was correct, but I wanted to be more stringent upon myself. And while I was lying there, I was accosted by bandits and I barely came away with my life. And the rabbi said to him in a very strict way, they said, you know, you endangered your life in order to follow the position of Bet Shammai. You should never have done a thing like that. This is how strongly they felt about instituting the halacha and not going beyond the halacha once the halacha was established. This brings us to the conclusion of the discussion of Rabbi Gamliel, and it brings us to a better understanding of what Rabbi Gamliel was facing when he attempted to bring together, to unite, the family of Israel. One final concluding thought is a little description that took of a discussion that took place during this period of time with regard to the question of levirate marriages. It was made known to the sages in Yavne that Reb Dosa ben Harkinas, this is the man that we have already had opportunity to come across when he was learning, we had opportunity to come across this man when he agreed with Rabbi Yehoshua on the question of Rosh Chodesh and he advised Rabbi Yehoshua to go to Rabbi Gamliel even on the day that Rabbi Yehoshua would have thought was Yom Kippur. This Rabbi Dosa ben Harkinas was a venerated sage. Rabbi Yehoshua consulted with him, and the sages of Yavne heard that Rabbi Dosa ruled in accordance with Shammai on the question of levirate marriage for a daughter's co-wife. So they immediately sent a delegation to Rabbi Dosa to clarify the position. And incidentally, when Rabbi Akiva came in, Rabbi Dosa said to him, are you the Akiva that your name, your reputation precedes you from one end of the world to the other end of the world? Have a seat. Anyway, so they started talking from one halacha to another halacha until they brought the conversation around to the question of levirate marriage. And they asked him what his position was. And so he said, my position is that of Beth Hillel. And so they said to him, but we heard that the Ben Harkinas says that the position follows that of Shammai. And so he asked them, what did you hear? Did you hear Reb Dosa Ben Harkinas, or did you hear Ben Harkinas? Because I have a brother, and my brother is a determined student of Shammai. His name is Yonatan. And he has 300 arguments to prove to you that the halakha follows Shammai's position in this particular issue. But I don't agree with him, because I remember and I can testify that it was right here on this seat that Haggai the prophet sat, and he made three statements. And one of them was that the halakha with regards to levirate marriages reflects that which we know today as Hillel's opinion. And he said to the sages, beware of my brother, because if you run into him, you'll see that he has so many arguments, it's hard to get away from him. It's hard to ignore or deny the compelling nature of his arguments. In fact, the Talmud says on his way out, Rabbi Akiva ran into Yonatan ben Harkinas, and they started talking, and in the end, Yonatan said to him, you are the Akiva, your reputation goes from one end of the world to the other end of the world, but as far as I am concerned, it seems that you haven't even reached the level of being a shepherd for cattle, a shepherd for oxen. And Rabbi Akiva, in his humility, replied, that's true, I'm not even a shepherd for sheep. But once again, this goes to show the incredible difficulty to overcome to people like Yonatan ben Harkinas, an incredible scholar with 300 arguments to prove Shammai's position. And here the sages of Yavne, when they heard that ben Harkinas approves of Shammai's position, they immediately sent a delegation because it was so important to them to establish the rule of the Sanhedrin's halacha. Bottom line is Rabbi Gamliel succeeded in his endeavor, and he fulfilled his goal. He had to give his life in order to fulfill it, but he was ultimately successful. This is the legacy that he left to the Jewish people, and it is in his merit that we continue to learn the Torah today as one tradition, one transmission of Torah from the days of Moshe all the way through until today.